So let me start by thanking the organizers for inviting me. So I'm not part of the elite circle who has plots by Flavio in their talk. I'm here as an outside observer, and it's been definitely interesting watching you debate over whether shape dynamics differs from GR in any observable way. On the classical level, I think the question seems to be open, but I would argue that on the quantum level, the two theories will definitely differ, and this is because they are based on different symmetries, and that plays a really important role in a quantum setup. And so what I will do here is basically give you an overview of tools that you can use if you want to understand quantum gravity, and it's called renormalization group flows of space-time because that's the perspective where I'm coming from. But really, the space-time isn't really the important bit. So you can apply the same type of setup in models where you're not thinking about a space-time description of gravity. So what I will do in this talk is take some time the outline comes later. So I will take some time to introduce the renormalization group because I think maybe part of the audience has heard about that in detail before, the other half hasn't. And then I will highlight applications to quantum gravity, and specifically I will tell you what happens when you get your hands really dirty on renormalization group flows in gravity and what the particular challenges are that you have to address in a quantum gravity setup that maybe don't arise in a setup where you're looking at standard quantum theories. Okay, so the starting point is, it's not really clear here, but this is meant to be a picture of a black hole singularity, and you can, on the classical level, describe that in different ways. But of course, the source of space-time curvature of geometry is matter, and matter has quantum properties. This means it fluctuates, and therefore any really consistent model of gravity in our universe actually has to take into account quantum effects. So this means that if you start zooming in to space-time, then beyond scales approximately at the level of the Planck scale, we expect to start to see fluctuations of gravity. And then, of course, if we zoom in even further, then nobody really has a very clear idea of what happens. And this is what I indicated by these two different options here. Of course, there are many more than just two different options. So space-time could either continue to fluctuate in a continuum setting. So this is what this upper picture here is meant to show. Or it could even break up into some form of pre-geometric, discrete type of building blocks. And of course, then there's a variety of other approaches. What I will tell you here is that the renormalization group is actually a useful tool to investigate many of these settings. So on the one hand, the renormalization group actually bridges the gap between these widely different scales, between classical gravity and between quantum gravity in the continuum, and it allows you to investigate whether, given a particular model and a particular set of fields and symmetries, whether you can find a consistent ultraviolet completion for that. So this is one of the things that you can do with the renormalization group. The other things that you can do is, if you're thinking that space-time in some sense falls apart into some form of pre-geometric discrete building blocks, then of course from this quantum setting, ultimately you want to recover this sort of smooth manifold type structure. So what you need to do is to take a continuum limit to get back to the continuum description. And here again, the renormalization group is a useful tool. So here's the outline. What I will do is take some time to introduce the functional renormalization group as a tool to probe the scale dependence generically in quantum field theories. And then I will specify to the case of quantum gravity. So I will talk about the renormalization group for space-time in the continuum. And of course, the big challenge about applying the renormalization group is that the renormalization group is all about setting a scale and distinguishing models or sort of effective descriptions of physics at different scales. But of course, in gravity, scales themselves start to fluctuate, at least in our standard space-time description. And so the question is, how can you reconcile these two ideas? How do you set a scale in a quantum gravity setting? And this might be even less obvious if you go to sort of discrete quantum gravity approaches where you can't even meaningfully talk about scales at all. How do you set a scale and how do you apply the renormalization group in this pre-geometric setting? Okay, so let's start with the functional renormalization group. So ultimately, when we are thinking about quantum theories, what we want to understand is a path integral over all possible field configurations, not just the classical solutions to the equation of motion. And doing this integral provides us with an effective action for the expectation value of the quantum field. And because here we are doing a functional integral, this means that the effective action in general is different from the microscopic or classical action. Now, the idea about the functional renormalization group is to not do this whole complicated path integral all at once, but to divide it up into more doable steps. And so what we define is an effective average action where not all quantum fluctuations contribute, but only the high momentum quantum fluctuations are integrated out. And we are leaving the low momentum quantum fluctuations for later. And so what this effective average action here does is that as a function of this momentum scale k, which you can think of as an inverse resolution scale, as a function of that scale, this effective action interpolates smoothly between the classical or microscopic action that you get when you haven't integrated out any quantum fluctuations at all, and the full effective action where you have integrated out all quantum fluctuations. And the way that this is achieved is we add a quadratic, so a mass-like term to the path integral. And note that I'm actually talking about Riemannian path integrals here, so this is not Lorentzian signature. And this mass-like term essentially is a term that allows us to dial this resolution scale. And one of the really important points that I will come back to later on is that for this setup here, it's really critical that this is really a quadratic term, so it acts like a mass, that it's not a higher order term. So this term then has to satisfy a number of requirements in order for this picture here to be realized. First of all, it has to vanish for the high momentum modes. So this means for the high momentum modes, this integral is completely unchanged, and therefore they are integrated over and they contribute to the effective action down here. For the low momentum modes, we're adding a finite mass-like term. And if you have a mass-like term here for these quantum fluctuations, this means that this suppresses those quantum fluctuations and they don't contribute to the functional integral yet. And one typical choice that is convenient for technical purposes is this shape down here, where essentially this theta function implements this idea that the cutoff has to vanish for the high momentum modes. Now, what's the big advantage of treating the functional integral in this way? The big advantage is that once we've done that, we can ultimately forget about the functional integral completely. And we will be able to derive an equation that that tells us about the scale-dependent change of this effective action. So first of all, what happens as we start to integrate out quantum fluctuations?
Yes? I'm a bit confused yet. So the mass goes to zero for high momentum modes?
Yes. And therefore, so it's an infrared cutoff. It suppresses the low momentum fluctuations. You're doing the path integral for the high momentum fluctuations first. And then you're lowering the cutoff further and further, and you're including quantum fluctuations towards the infrared further and further. Okay, so what happens as we do that is that because we are doing an integral over the high momentum modes, which are coupled to the low momentum modes, it means that the interaction strength changes in the various interaction terms that we have, and you can parameterize that by a scale-dependent change in the coupling constants, which parameterize the interaction strengths.
Could I say the interaction strength change precisely because you're doing this device of cutting out?
Because you're doing the integral. Simply because the high momentum modes.
It's a human induced change.
Well, it's a human induced change, but also, I mean, there's also, if you look at the bare values of the couplings, they will be different from the ones that you get in the deep infrared, simply because you're doing this integral and the high momentum modes and the low momentum modes are coupled. But of course, the scale k, as I've introduced it here, first of all, is not a physical scale. It's just as a mathematical tool that I introduce in order to make this integral more doable. Okay. The second thing that happens apart from the fact.
Something I said, so you have two phis there. There's a bare phi and then regular phi.
So this vanished. So this phi here, that's the expectation value. So the effective action is that gives you the equations of motion for the expectation value of the quantum field. That obviously doesn't make any sense. So what I meant to write, is there any chalk? Sorry. Okay. Right. Okay. The second thing that happens is that the interaction strengths not only change in those interactions that you have included in the microscopic action, but actually in this process you generate further interaction terms. And one example for that is in quantum electrodynamics, which of course doesn't have any photon-photon interactions microscopically because it's an abelian gauge theory, but as soon as you start integrating out fermion fluctuations, you generate an effective photon-photon interaction term. And so therefore what this means is that doing this path integral takes you into an infinite dimensional space of couplings, namely all those couplings that are compatible with the symmetries and the field content. And this is one of those points where you can see that shape dynamics and GR will presumably be very different on the quantum level because the underlying theory space will just be completely different because it's governed by completely different symmetries. Yes?
What's your attitude toward the Wick rotation?
Yes. So we have to do it for technical reasons. Of course, it's not quite clear whether in a quantum gravity setting you can Wick rotate back. So really, strictly speaking, this will be a quantum theory of spaces, not of space times. And then, of course, you can try to upgrade that and ultimately look at renormalization group flows in a Lorentzian setting, but it's technically much more challenging. Yeah.
But I suppose there's another difference in shape dynamics where we would, I guess, be automatically.
It depends on
Well, I mean,
you can still do a Wick rotation, right? And still have a 3 plus 1. I mean, you can have a 3 plus 1 split where the 1 is not distinguished by its signature, right? So you could still apply that. Okay. Great. So the big advantage of this whole setup is that ultimately we can now completely forget about the underlying path integral because once we've made this definition, we can straightforwardly derive this equation down here, which is a differential equation that tells us about the scale-dependent change of the effective action. So instead of doing a functional integral that, of course, isn't particularly well-defined, we are just looking at this functional differential equation down here. And basically, this right-hand side here, the way that you can think about this is really just the non-perturbative propagator of the theory, and the supertrace runs over the eigenvalues of that propagator, which in a flat space would just be a momentum integral. And so the right-hand side here is just essentially a one-loop integral with this regulator insertion denoted by this dot up here. So what this means is that the change of the effective dynamics at a scale k is driven by a loop integral over quantum fluctuations, just as you would expect. Now, what is the big advantage of that? Well, the path integral and this equation down here, which is now known as the Wetterich equation, they are completely equivalent. So for any model where you can write down a path integral, you can introduce a regulator term, and then it's essentially straightforward to derive an equation like that. So in some sense, you can take this as the underlying definition of your quantum field theory. You can forget about the path integral, which isn't necessarily well-defined.
The other arrow?
Yeah. I will come back to this question of the classical action.
Where does the regulator come from?
So this is just something that you impose. It has to satisfy a number of requirements, but essentially there is some freedom in choosing this function.
Is it related to the scale that is given by the expectation value of this function?
Not necessarily. So the k really is just an external scale that you put in. So it does. There is no necessary. There isn't any relation to that a priori. Okay. The big advantage of the Wetterich equation is that it's automatically ultraviolet and infrared finite. This means that this loop integral that you do here will actually be peaked for momenta in the vicinity of k, which is actually exactly what you would expect. The change in the effective dynamics will be driven by quantum fluctuations at that scale. And since it's UV and infrared finite, it's just you can just straightforwardly evaluate this and you get a finite expression for the scale-dependent change of the effective action. Now, Flavio's question, where do I get the microscopic or classical action from? So down here, the microscopic or classical action doesn't enter anymore. It enters once you decide that you want to integrate this equation. Then, of course, you need an initial condition in the ultraviolet, and you can choose this to be some form of classical action. But in general, of course, this equation just gives you a flow all over theory space. So it, in some sense, tells you what happens for all possible microscopic actions, which correspond to different points in theory space. But of course, you can reverse this and flow towards the ultraviolet and check whether there's a consistent choice of the microscopic action so that the whole path integral actually becomes consistent. And I will come back to that. I think I will not get through my talk in time, but yeah, go ahead.
So is UTNR finite because you have derivatives of the regulator there?
Yeah, so the infrared finite is because you always have this finite mass sitting down here, which even if you have massless fields, it's in some sense gives you a mass-like term for those. And this derivative of the regulator, that makes it UV finite because the regulator vanishes for the high momentum mode. So that cuts off the UV part of the integral. Okay, and one last thing to emphasize is this is a one-loop equation technically. So this makes it actually really, really useful for practical calculations. If it wasn't a one-loop equation, doing this whole thing in quantum gravity would be much, much more complicated. But it's not a one-loop equation in the sense that nowhere in this derivation did we use perturbation theory or anything like that. So the propagator that we have here is the full non-perturbative propagator. Okay, now how can we use this in quantum gravity? We can actually use this in quantum gravity in two directions. First of all, you could say, well, I have some idea of what my field content and my symmetries should be, and I want to understand whether, given that, I can find a consistent quantum field theoretic ultraviolet completion. So here, you're searching for a UV completion, you're using the renormalization group towards the ultraviolet. The second idea would be that you have The second use would be that you have some idea of what the microscopic action should be, and then you can just flow in the sort of more traditional direction towards the infrared, integrate out quantum fluctuation starting from the microscopic dynamics, and test whether from your idea for the microscopic dynamics you can get back to observed infrared physics. So this is more towards sort of connecting to observations and testing whether your model is actually compatible with what we know about our universe. And I will try to say something about both of these arrows. So first of all, searching for an ultraviolet completion, what is necessary in order to have an ultraviolet consistent model in a quantum field theoretic setup? So quantum field theories can be either fundamental, which means that they actually hold over an infinite range of scales, in particular all the way towards the ultraviolet, towards smallest scales, or they can be effective. And in that case, you encounter something that's called a Landau-Polar triviality problem. And let me quickly show you how that looks like. So here I'm showing you a running coupling as a function of the momentum scale. And this red dashed line, that's a coupling that runs into a Landau pole. And this divergence in the coupling, of course, means that at that scale, physical observables would diverge. And therefore, we conclude that new physics must exist beyond that scale, lambda. That could be either new degrees of freedom or even a complete change of the framework. And note this asterisk up here. What it says is that perturbative renormalizability, so the ability to absorb the divergences from loop diagrams by a redefinition of the original couplings in your theory, that's actually not sufficient to have a fundamental theory. So the best example for that are lambda 5-4 theory and QED. Both of them are perturbatively renormalizable, but both of them, if you look at the scale dependence of the renormalized couplings, they diverge at a finite scale. So this means that they are effective theories which work extremely well over a finite range of scale, but they break down if we go towards the ultraviolet. So instead, what we need in order to get a fundamental theory is a behavior either like that or like that, where the theory approaches a renormalization group fixed point. What that means is that we are encountering a scale invariant regime, so the couplings stop changing, stop running as a function of scale. They just approach constant values. And once you are in such a regime, of course, nothing keeps you from just zooming into arbitrary small scales. You don't run into any divergences. And so therefore, you have a fundamental theory. So there is, in this setup, no need to introduce any new physics. And there are two different versions of that. The better known one is asymptotic freedom. That plays a more important role within the standard model in high energy physics. The other option of an interacting fixed point actually plays a huge role in statistical physics and high energy physics. It's not been explored so much. But for gravity, one might expect that asymptotic safety is actually the more important concept. One important thing in this whole setup is here I've just shown you one particular coupling. But before, I've told you that this whole RG flow actually takes place in an infinite dimensional space of couplings. So how do we get this whole thing to be predictive? Well, the critical or the important thing is that if you have such a fixed point somewhere in theory space, typically there will just be a finite number of ultraviolet attractive directions. So this means most directions will be like this orange curve where you slightly depart from what is called the critical surface, and then you will be repulsed by the fixed point as you go towards the ultraviolet, and up here you just run into a divergence, so this is not a fundamental theory. So in order to have a fundamental theory, you actually have to lie within this critical surface, which is typically finite dimensional. Yes?
So this is the question. What if you have a Landau pole, but it's only at infinity of k?
So those examples where the coupling really only diverges at infinity, that means you actually have a perfectly well-defined theory, and there are some examples where this has been seen, I think. I think you should, in that case, be able to do a redefinition of your couplings to move that fixed point to some finite point in theory space. Yeah. So why do we expect this critical surface to be finite dimensional? Well, this is because if we are at an asymptotically free fixed point, then it's only those couplings with vanishing or positive mass dimensionality which are UV attractive. So all those interactions that we would sort of in standard quantum field theory language call higher order interactions, those are automatically ultraviolet repulsive, and therefore their values are predicted. And at an interacting fixed point, this correspondence between the ultraviolet repulsive couplings and the higher order interactions presumably still holds approximately as long as this fixed point isn't too non-perturbative. Okay, and of course, as I said before, in this whole setup here, symmetries matter. So if you have a different theory space, this changes whether or not you can have a fixed point, and obviously this also changes what the ultraviolet attractive directions are. Okay, now this is the whole setup. What I would now like to do is switch gears a little bit and delve right into one of the problems or the challenges that one gets when one wants to apply that setup to quantum gravity. And the challenge is that, well, we want to do a path integral over the metric, either in a 3+1 split way or not. But in any case, we are typically looking at a setting where we don't have any fixed background scale. But on the other hand, in order to apply the RG, we need to be able to distinguish high momentum and low momentum modes. So how do we do that? Well, essentially it boils down to the question of how do you introduce a regulator term if you're looking at the path integral over the metric. And the first thing that you could do would be just to say, well, on a flat background, we just use the momentum squared in this regulator here. So let's just generalize that. Let's just use the covariant Laplacian in here. And then you would write down a regulator term like that for the metric, and you would try to derive the flow equation. As I emphasized in the beginning, it's really critical that this mass-like term that we introduce is really mass-like, which means it has to be quadratic in the fields, because otherwise the flow equation will not be a one-loop equation, and then it's actually much more difficult to do anything for practical purposes with it.
So quadratic in G or in the perturbation to G?
Here's no split. So I'll be coming to the split, right? So this is not quadratic in the metric because, of course, there are Christoffel symbols in the covariant Laplacian, and they depend on the metric. So this is clearly higher order, even infinitely higher order in the metric. It's not a mass-like term for the metric, and that destroys the one-loop structure of the flow equation. So that's something that we don't want to do. Yes?
And D is the covariant derivative with respect to some...
With respect to this metric at that point.
But the metric. That's zero. Covariant derivative of metric.
Yes, right. That's even another problem, yeah. Very good. Yes. So even apart from that doesn't work. So
to the minus. Okay.
Yes. So therefore, what we typically do in this whole setup is
the flash.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So none of this works. Yes. So what we typically do, also because we actually need to introduce the gauge fixing, but I will ignore that for the rest of this talk, is we use a background feed method where we take our metric and split it in some way into a background piece and a fluctuation piece, and there are different ways to do that. But what this allows us to do is now we have a fluctuation piece, and that's the one that we want to sort of integrate over in the path integral, and we have an appropriate generalization of the momentum, namely the covariant Laplacian with respect to this background metric. And so this is a way of writing down a mass-like term for the metric fluctuations, which sort of loosely speaking, you can think about gravitons. Right, and they depend on this background metric. And this is something that leaves the one-loop structure of the flow equation intact. But in quantum gravity, unlike at this conference, there is no free lunch. So the fact that we have arrived at a flow equation that has a one-loop structure and that we can use in practice doesn't come for free. Because what we did in this process is we broke background independence. So background independence is essentially the statement that there is really only one metric, that the effect of action just depends on the expectation value of the one physical metric, that there isn't a sort of special background metric. And this shift symmetry is encoded, this shift symmetry is just a shift of the fluctuation and the background by equal opposite bits. And of course, if everything really just depends on the full metric, then everything will be symmetric under this shift symmetry. So the shift symmetry is just the statement that we are background independent. But of course, this is clearly broken by the regulator term. And this actually has important consequences for the RG flow, because as soon as the regulator breaks a particular symmetry, then the RG flow will also break that symmetry, regardless of what you choose as your initial condition. And this means that we will live now in a not only infinite dimensional theory space, but significantly more infinite dimensional. So specifically, for instance, if you would say, well, I'm interested in exploring the renormalization group flow of the Newton coupling, then if you insert this split here, then you can expand this term here into a background piece plus something linear in the fluctuation field, quadratic, cubic, and to arbitrary high order. And all of these sort of avatars of the Newton coupling, if you are in a background independent setting, then they all flow in the same way. But because of this background dependence from the regulator, these beta functions will actually differ. Let me not talk about the water identity. So that means there is no free lunch, but how expensive is it actually to apply these techniques to gravity? In other words, how strong is this background dependence? So one way to test this is to just explicitly compare the flow of different versions of the Newton coupling. And for instance, if you look at gravity metasystems, then you can define a Newton coupling from a 3-graviton vertex, a 4-graviton vertex, or something like a scalar, 2-scalar graviton, or 2-scalar 2-graviton vertex, and so on. What we did together with Roberto a while ago was to compare the beta function for the background Newton coupling to the one for this particular graviton scalar coupling. Yes?
Why is it a problem that the RG flows are the actual beta functions are different? I mean, is it more that, because those are not really observables anyway, right? Isn't it what you want, like the critical exponents?
Yes, but I mean, ultimately, you are now in an enlarged theory space, right? And all of these different versions of the Newton coupling, they couple into each other. So you can't simply decide that you ignore those newly generated directions. That's actually you know, the projection that introduces an error. And so you really need to work in this enlarged theory space, but then ultimately there will be a hypersurface that corresponds to the water identity onto which you then want to check whether the flow in this enlarged theory space, whether you can put that onto that surface. But it's not consistent to simply say, well, I'm going to ignore the fact that there are different versions of the couplings, because in particular, it's the couplings of the fluctuation field that also drive the flow in the background sector. So it's inconsistent to make simple approximations. Okay, so here I'm comparing the beta function for the background Newton coupling to the one from the graviton scalar coupling. And it's actually much easier to just look at the plot here, where you see that qualitatively they are similar. In particular, we have this asymptotically safe fixed point in both versions. We also have the fact that if you increase the number of scalars denoted by NS, then that will ultimately destroy the gravity fixed point. We then took that one step further. So this is work in collaboration with Roberto's student and a bunch of people in Heidelberg that's to appear soon. So then we also included the 3-graviton coupling. And here I'm showing you the fixed point values for all of these couplings as a function of the number of scalars. And you see, of course, there are differences, quantitative differences, but the qualitative behavior is similar. So to sum up this, the answer to this question, how expensive is it? Well, there is a quantitative difference between these different beta functions, but there is qualitative agreement. So we would call that something like an effective universality. So the background dependence introduced by the regulator is there, but doesn't actually seem to be too bad. In particular, the qualitative behavior, namely that an increasing number of scalars drive gravity into a strong gravity regime, that is actually similar. And one of the questions that I would have to use shape dynamics, guys, is, well, is the behavior of matter in quantum shape dynamics actually similar or not? And in particular, this is interesting because that, of course, establishes a contact between quantum gravity to sort of beyond standard model phenomenology. And of course, one would like to understand whether different versions of quantum gravity are all compatible with matter as we know it or not. And I would assume that because of the changed symmetries of theory space, there could be differences in cases like that. Yes? So, say again?
Like, how do you derive the back-end?
This one? So for this one, you're just, for instance, doing heat kernel techniques, and you're just choosing a particular background, for instance, a sphere, on which it's actually the spectrum of the covariant Laplacian is known, and then it's actually straightforward using heat kernel techniques to just project onto the curvature. Okay. So in my remaining 3 minutes or so, I would very briefly like to address this other arrow, namely the question, so here I've told you how to search for UV completion in a sort of quantum field theoretic setting, but then another thing that you could do is going away from this geometric setting and not thinking about sort of metric-related variables at all, but about quantum gravity in a more pre-geometric setting, and how do you set a scale, and how do you make the connection back to gravity as we know it in that case. And so this is actually work together with Tim that I'm reporting on here. So how do you set a scale in a pre-geometric setting? And this is actually a more general question, but of course the renormalization group flow doesn't only have this interpretation as going from high momentum modes to low momentum modes. In a more abstract way, it also has this interpretation of going from many degrees of freedom to sort of fewer or coarser degrees of freedom. And this interpretation you can actually keep in very, very abstract settings, in particular in abstract quantum gravity settings, where at the microscopic level you've completely forgotten about anything like a manifold and anything like the scales. You're just talking about many and few degrees of freedom. This is sort of the more abstract thing, and now I will just talk about very specific models and show you how to implement it there. And these models are matrix or tensor models, so think of an n by n matrix. So then the path integral just goes over the different entries in that matrix or tensor, and typically you choose an action that is just a particular invariant. Physically, these matrix models are also tensor models, correspond to a discrete path integral over space-time configurations. And of course, what we are ultimately interested in this setting is taking the continuum limit back. So this is essentially just saying that if you look at the dual to the Feynman diagrams of this matrix models, this gives you a way of summing over all possible tessellations of two-dimensional or higher dimensional surfaces. And of course, what we are interested in now is taking the continuum limit. And in these models, the continuum limit, where the contribution from more complicated topologies is taken into account, corresponds to a double scaling limit, where we take the number, the size of the matrix to infinity. So this means we're taking the number of degrees of freedom to infinity. And at the same time, we're tuning the coupling to a critical value while we hold this combination fixed. And so far, this doesn't actually look very much like anything that would have to do with the renormalization group. But if you look at the universal scaling near renormalization group fixed points, then you realize that this is actually of exactly the same form as this double scaling limit. So the universal scaling near renormalization group fixed points, if you look at the linearized flow, then the distance of the coupling to the fixed point value scales with k to the minus, this exponent here is called the critical exponent. And you see that if you rearrange this equation, you get exactly the double scaling limit. And so this means that the double scaling limit can be recovered if you set up the renormalization group not as a function of some momentum scale, but as a function of the matrix size. Right? And this is exactly this interpretation that I highlighted, that the RG flow goes from many degrees of freedom to fewer degrees of freedom. And this was first realized by Brezin and Zinjestin in the 90s, and Tim and I adapted that to a functional renormalization group setting. In that setting, it might not be as obvious, but the symmetries that this model has, namely a particular UN invariance where you can rotate in every index separately, that is again broken by the regulator. So the application of the quantum gravity of the renormalization group in any quantum gravity setting always seems to come at a price. And again, it's just because the introduction of the regulator violates that particular symmetry. Okay.
Yeah, I find that confusing. I thought N is the regulator.
So there's, you can think of the, this is like a UV cutoff, N prime, and then you're introducing a regulator which sort of integrates out the last row and column of that matrix and goes towards smaller matrices. And of course, if you do that, then you break this original UN prime times UN prime symmetry that you had in your original matrix model.
But you have to do that? With N finite, your path integral is finite.
Yes, so of course you could also decide to just do this path integral as it stands here, or try to do that. For matrix models, there is machinery that allows you to do that exactly. For tensor models, it's more complicated. So this is so the whole FRG setup is a sort of complementary tool that you can also apply to the path integral in order to solve it. But as I said, it comes at a price.
Great.
Okay. So in my remaining 30 seconds.
Yes. And if you change it in prime, you change the theory space, right? The group changes. Does that make sense?
No, but the invariants that you have are always the same. So whether you look at sort of 2x2 or 3x3 matrices, the types of invariants that you can write down that are dominated by that symmetry, they are always the same. So the theory space doesn't change. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Let me skip. This is just a cute little fact that you don't need to think too hard when you apply the functional renormalization group. You don't need to know what the scaling dimensionality of your couplings is. The RG equation will spit that out for you. In this tensor model setting that I'm highlighting here, the RG also generates higher order terms, which you can represent in this nice graphical way. And the only thing that I would like to highlight is sort of more recent results together with Tim, where we looked at rank 3 tensor models and looked at whether we can recover the double scaling limit that Razvan Gura and friends discovered. What you can see here, let me just quickly highlight that. Whoops. Ah, stuck. Okay, so. Okay, right. So let me just highlight that from these different truncations, what you're seeing here is that we have estimates for the critical exponents. There are two different schemes in which we calculate them. And as we go towards larger truncations, we seem to be getting closer. So these different estimates seem to be getting closer to each other, and they sort of roughly fall into that right area that you would expect here. But of course, quantitatively, this is not particularly convincing yet. And as you can see here, we've used quite a large truncation with actually 14 different couplings, and we are attributing the fact that it's difficult to obtain quantitative precision. We're attributing that to the fact that also in this discrete setting, the application of the renormalization group violates the symmetries that we have in that setting. Just one other fun thing that we can do with the functional renormalization group that goes beyond what has been done with other methods is discovering fixed points that would go beyond double scaling, and where you would, in principle, possibly discover a continuum limit that where you recover a different continuum spacetime where different contributions are taken into account. So this is something that is presumably more difficult to achieve in other setups, and where the full strength of the FRG really is highlighted. So let me not say anything about my summary, and apologies for going over time.
Further questions? Have I said that the region flow can be treated as a first order approximation for renormalization group flow? Mm-hmm. And with the region flow, you're working with Riemannian metrics, and you say DDT of metric is equal to reach. So is there anything like that you can do for, when you talk about renormalization, group flow can take objects and see time derivatives of them or equal to something and then
mm-hmm.
and analyze that? Is that just, I mean, I heard something in the picture you're talking about here before, but it would be nice if there was some way to do that.
Yes, yeah, so I think the closest that we can do is sort of try to come up with particular observables. Or for instance, you could call something like maybe, you know, you could look at something like the expectation value for the metric, which of course isn't really an observable, but just, you know, to give one example. And then if you have the flow for the effect of action, that of course the solution gives you the expectation value of the metric as a function of the different scale. And so you can see how does the expectation value of the metric, how does that change as you change the sort of resolution scale.
Right.
So I think that sort of...
Can you write that as a partial differential equation or no?
Yeah, so ultimately you can write that as a partial differential equation for the solution to the sort of scale-dependent equation of motion because you have the partial differential equation that tells you how the effect of action changes as a function of scale. So you're just taking that, and then you just have to take an additional functional derivative with respect to your field.
I may project,
yeah.
I think a different answer to your question is that the Ricci flow actually does arise in renormalization group, but not for gravity, in the case of sigma models.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. They always say that it's done, but I don't know enough about the quantum stuff to understand. You know, for example, if you wanted to go, that's first order, if I write a second order equation, does that make sense, or high order? Do those things make sense as a partial differential equation that you can study mathematically?
The RT is always first order.
Yeah, it's always.
I think that they've got this in the sigma model world, but four loops. So, yeah, it remains first order in the higher order curve, the higher loop curve.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about the flow between continuous and discrete structures.
Mm-hmm.
So if I understand the picture correctly, you're basically the flow is generated by changing the coupling constant, and,
mm-hmm.
but you're staying within, in some sense or other, staying a theory space that is related just by changing coupling constant scale.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me like a physical picture for how this changing coupling strength takes you from continuous to discrete, or
so you can really think about this very much like a phase transition. So this is just like, you know, at second and higher order phase transitions, in the vicinity of the phase transition, you have universal scaling. And so in statistical physics, you can actually recover the scaling exponents just by looking at renormalization group fixed points of the appropriate models. And in some sense, this is sort of similar here. So this continuum limit, in some sense, is like a phase transition from this phase where you have sort of this pre-geometric phase to the continuum phase. And you get to that phase transition because you tune to a critical point. At that critical point, the expectation value of the area diverges. And so if you take the number of your building blocks to infinity and the area diverges, you can simultaneously take the size of each building block to zero. And that happens at
like
a critical
the
value of the coupling.
This is like the lattice.
In some sense, yes.
Which is the same to the thing you do in lattice calculus.
But in the phase transition picture, I have a fixed background kinematical structure that all the stuff is defined with respect to. And here, like, everything is up for grabs. I mean, there's no background fixed
yep.
structure. And so I'm just trying to get a grip on what it kind of means physically to say
mm-hmm.
that every single thing is
yeah.
discrete, or everything is it's all continuous. Like, how does that work? I'm just having a hard time seeing how that transition happens. We're talking about space, something
yeah.
like space-time geometry.
So I wouldn't necessarily take this as a physical transition, right? I would really just, I mean, of course, you know, you could also go one step further and say this is a physical transition that happened, you know, and that was the Big Bang or whatever, but, you know, if you stay really conservative, then this is just a mathematical way of dealing with your path integral, and then this is just a mathematical transition. So there is nothing external that tunes your coupling, it's just something that you do mathematically to recover that point. Yeah, and also, you know, that if you are in this setting here, then of course you would hope that sort of the renormalization group scaling near fixed points in the continuous setting, that is actually the same as the one that you see in this discrete setting, so that you can really sort of connect the two pictures to each other. Yeah.
That's true. Just at one key point, you used the word tessellation.
Yes.
I was asking before about Stephen's theory about these matrices. Are they free-floating? And he said it he's recently sort of attaching his matrices to points in space. I mean, how the thing that has always bothered me with these discrete things, which where you haven't got them firmly connected up in a continuum, how do things join up? Maybe that was in your answer to the previous question. But I did notice when you said that word tessellation, it sounded to me as if these matrices were connected up in some way which went beyond the fact that they were matrices.
Yes, so if you look at the Feynman diagram expansion in these models, if you look at the Feynman diagram expansion and you look at Feynman diagrams where you're really connecting up many, many vertices and then you're just drawing the duals of that diagram, then that is the tessellation of the 2D surfaces. So it's just a mathematical representation. So as I said, I would view this as a mathematical tool to deal with the path integral. I wouldn't take this picture of sort of freely floating building blocks of space-time too serious in a physical sense. And so then this is just the translation of, you know, you're really interested in understanding the continuum limit of all possible configurations of space-time. You discretize that, and then you can translate that into this matrix
so
model setting.
The idea is there is a space-time which you discretize. So it's sort of...
No, the idea is that the building block is associated with a square. And when you sum over pairs of indices, that's associated with putting two sides of the square together, adjacent. And so the prescription for how you sum over the indices of the tensors and the matrices reproduces a picture of putting a surface together from building blocks, squares or triangles. Right.
The check.
Oh, you wanted to see.
I've had my hand up for
Yeah. So I'm wondering about the implications of this broken background independence.
In the continuum.
In the first part. Yeah. Does it mean that somehow if we are making physical predictions from these renormalized couplings, they depend on the choice of background? And if so, how are we supposed to think about it?
Whether the background part, whether that the background. Okay, let me go one step back. So typically, in order to evaluate the flow equation, you need to choose a particular background in order to be able to do the integral. And then, of course, you want to convince yourself that, you know, universal properties near the fixed point are independent of that choice of background. And so you can then compare, you know, the fixed point properties on a flat background and on a spherical background, for instance. And they don't seem to differ too much. There is a quantitative difference. And also, of course, it's important that, you know, coupling constants aren't directly physical observables. So you need to make that step from the couplings to physical observables, and you would, of course, hope that at that level the non-universal, unphysical choices drop out.
But you don't know whether that's the case.
Well, give me a good observable in quantum gravity.
Well, I mean, if there's a statement that Newton's constant depends on the energy at which you smash things together,
mm-hmm.
That seems like a directly observable thing.
So the scaling exponents, for instance, that tell you how couplings change in the vicinity of fixed points and that will ultimately in some way enter observables, they are to a large degree independent, for instance, of the choice of regulator in all of these questions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we had a question back there.
So you said that that the trisc invariants get affected. Okay, so you choose, I guess, in the tensor model,
mm-hmm.
you use for in the interaction terms some invariants of the
mm-hmm.
of this group.
Yes.
UN. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get affected means that the term, the interaction term that you turns into another invariant or.
So what happens here is that first of all, if you start from some set of interactions, for instance, something like that, which you can draw pictorially like that, that first of all, what will happen is that higher order tensor invariants will be generated automatically by the RG flow from these lower order ones. So this is the first thing that happens. But also because of the breaking of that symmetry by the regulator, you actually generate additional terms which aren't really trace invariants, but where you get an index-dependent prefactor. So you're really flowing out of that space of these simple trace invariants. And this is something that we've ignored in this truncation here.
Okay. Okay, but the result is still trace invariant, right? So you're going to have.
So it's not a simple trace invariant, but you will have a function that depends on the indices in front.
Oh, okay.
So it really breaks that symmetry and gives you sort of more complicated interaction terms.
Okay. So last question, really.
Yeah, so I want to query your intuition that shape dynamics and general relativity have different renormalization structures.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me if it's a long discussion, we can postpone to the discussion. But if I construct the partition function for general relativity, I impose the constraints. I have a delta function of the constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a delta function of the gauge fixing.
Mm-hmm.
So the story of shape dynamics is that there's a particular kind of gauge fixing associated with constant mean curvature slicing, which you can trade, you can decide later which you consider the generator gauge transformation, which you consider the gauge fixing. So I would think that the partition function would be identical in shape dynamics
mm-hmm.
and general relativity, because it's symmetric in the consideration of which is the gauge fixing, which is the generator
mm-hmm.
of the gauge constraint.
Mm-hmm. Good question, but I mean, so one of the differences between shape dynamics and GR seems to be that the allowed field configurations are really different ones, right? And so when you're just thinking of the path integral as different as summing over all different field configurations, then that would be obviously different. I think it maybe we should discuss this in more detail how this fits to your intuition, but. Just in general, I mean, in this picture here, where you're just thinking of, you know, you're starting from an action and you're imposing the gauge fixing, but you're not thinking in a Hamiltonian way and imposing the constraints. The theory space is definitely different, right? Because the allowed interactions that are generated by the flow, they will differ. And then, of course, you can still, if you have two totally different theory spaces, you can still have classically equivalent models, because a classical model is just a single point in the theory space. And it seems to me that, you know, for instance, GR and shape dynamics fall into that class. So also GR and unimodular gravity, which, you know, are equivalent classically, they also fall into that class, where this one particular point that is the classical model agrees, but then the flow away from that just probes different spaces and therefore differs.
It's a longer discussion. Let's do it in the discussion section.
Yeah.
All right, let's thank Astrid again.